and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is America, Roosevelt, and the Causes of the Present War. And it was written by Ezra Pound, and this is a copy that was published in 1951. The incidents of the war in the process of history and the fate of revolutions. This war was not caused by any caprice on Mussolini's part, nor on Hitler's. This war is part of the secular war between usurers and peasants, between the usurocracy and whomever does an honest day's work with his own brain or hands. I don't know how many books one may have to read in order to understand this simple sentence, but a writer of history must count more on the selection of facts than on the bulk of exposition. A few pages of a writer like George Obst are worth more than the whole of D.R. Dewey's financial history, because Obst seeks to make himself clear to the reader, whereas Dewey sought to produce a work useful to the plutocratic bosses. The historical process has been understood at various times, but this understanding on the part of a diligent minority, fighting for the public good, is again and again thrust down beneath the surface. In 1878, my grandfather said the same things that I am saying now, but the memory of his efforts has been obliterated. The same applies to the revelations of men like Calhoun, Jackson, and Van Buren. 40 years ago, Brooks Adams assembled some very significant facts, but his books were not widely read. He had no vocation for martyrdom, he confessed with irony. There are perhaps 30 books, a knowledge of which will enable us to understand how the American Revolution has been and is still being continued by the Italian Revolution, but none of these 30 books will be found on the bookstalls. It took me 7 years to get hold of a set of the works of John Adams, published in 1850 to 1856, in 10 volumes, edited with a Life of the Author by Charles Francis Adams, grandson of the Father of the Nation. Besides, these works are partly incomprehensible to anyone who is not already provided with some knowledge of economic, or more specifically, monetary matters. If you can understand the cause or causes of one war, you will understand the cause or causes of several, and perhaps of all. But the fundamental causes of war have received little publicity. Schoolbooks do not disclose the inner workings of banks. The mystery of economics has been more jealously guarded than were ever the mysteries of Eleusis. And the central bank of Greece was at Delphi. In the 19th century, the public more or less believed that political economy had been invented by Adam Smith. Regius professorships were founded to falsify history and to teach wiggery, and even the Tudor monarchs used to talk about tuning the pulpits. The cardinal fact of the American Revolution of 1776 was the suppression, in 1750, of the paper money issue in Pennsylvania and other colonies. But history, as taught in the USA, speaks of more picturesque matters, such as the Boston Tea Party. Ethics arise with agriculture. The ethics of the nomad do not go beyond the distinction between my sheep and your sheep. If the study of Aristotle and Demosthenes had not actually been suppressed, it has at least been soft-pedaled for perfectly deliberate and definite reasons. Certain classical authors speak too frankly for the tastes of the grand seigneurs of usury. The terminology of financial operations has already been studied and set forth with uncommon seriousness by Claudius Salmasius in De Modo Usurum and De Funor Trapezitico in 1639 and 1640, but even those encyclopedias that mention his name tend to ignore these two books. What constitutes a sound basis of credit was already known and affirmed at the beginning of the 17th century by the founders of the Monte dei Paschi of Siena. It was and is the abundance or the productive capacity of nature taken together with the responsibility of the whole people. I quote these apparently unconnected facts to indicate that certain high crimes are not due to any negligence on the part of a handful of scholars and cannot be attributed to the ignorance of the whole of humanity, but that they can only happen on account of the ignorance of the great majority. What the sages understood was recorded, but inscriptions disappear, books decay, while usurocratic publicity floods the public's mind like a muddy tide, and the same greed, the same iniquities and monopolies rise up again, subjecting the world to their foul dominion. St. Ambrose went straight to the point. Hoggers of harvests, cursed, cursed among the people. The history of usury begins with the loans of seed corn in Babylon in the 3rd millennium BC. The first mention I know of a state monetary policy refers to the year 1766 BC, when an emperor of China, in order to alleviate the distress caused by famine and aggravated by grain monopolizers, opened a copper mine and coined discs of metal perforated with a square hole. We read that he gave this money to the starving, and that they could then buy grain where the grain was. It is not known whether the emperor invented the idea, or if he followed a benevolent precedent, but one can see that he understood the nature and the social purpose of money, as well as one of the limitations of its power. A similar wisdom emerges from the phrase in the recent fascist Republican program, "Not the rights of property, but the rights to property." The decrees of the Emperor Frederick II, King of Sicily, used to begin with God the Eternal and the creation of the world. This medieval style precludes any ideas that social factors are without roots. My ignorance and yours, and that of the surrounding public, is not today a natural phenomenon. Above and beyond natural ignorance and artificial ignorance is diffused, artificially created by the usurocratic press, by several kinds of organisations striving to preserve their monopolies and privileges. The basic fact of the history of the United States of America is the suppression, aforementioned, of the colonial paper money, 56 years after the foundation of the private Bank of England, so-called. Among the definitions of the word banker, collected by Obst, we find: a banker is one who buys money and debts, creating other debts. A banker is one who borrows money to lend it again at a profit, i.e. at a higher rate of interest. The advanced stage in the development of the usurer's cunning, marked by the foundation of the above-mentioned bank, was clearly registered in Patterson's prospectus. The bank hath benefit of the interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing. Patterson, in other words, proposed to lend not money, but notes, gambling on the very likely probability that only a small fraction of the depositors would ever want to withdraw their money at the same time. And the trick came off, and in a grand way. But the Quakers of Pennsylvania were beginning to enter into competition, pro bono publico Pennsylvanico. That is to say, they lent their paper money to farmers for purposes of land reclamation up to an amount equal to half the value of the land in question, requiring repayment in 10 annual instalments. The bank in the mother country, through the instrumentality of the British government, had this beneficial competition, which had brought prosperity to the colonies, suppressed in 1750. After various other vexations, the colonies declared their independence, which they achieved thanks to their geographical position and to the perturbed state of Europe. The emperor, Qing Tang, had understood the distributive function of money. Aristotle is right in saying that the Greeks called money nomisma because it was a product not of nature, but of man. Money is, in the first place, an instrument of the will. The economic conditions of a society depend on the will of its rulers, hindered by ignorance or contrasting will powers. It is true to say that the purely economic man does not exist, if we mean that the economic problem cannot be solved without allowing for human will as one of its components. The purpose of a monopoly is to be able to sell the material or product monopolized at an unjustly inflated price, scorning the public good and victimizing one's neighbor. During the last 30 years, the news stands and bookshops have displayed and sold a considerable number of more or less approximative works retailing the affairs of various monopolies of petrol and of metals, etc., but the great whodunit of money never appeared among them. In a certain sense, Brooks Adams had written it, but not in popular form. The kernel of his exposition is contained in the following paragraph. Perhaps no financier has ever lived abler than Samuel Lloyd. Certainly he understood, as few men, even of later generations, have understood, the mighty engine of the single standard. He comprehended that, with expanding trade, an inelastic currency must rise in value. He saw that, with sufficient resources at command, his class might be able to establish such a rise almost at pleasure. Certainly that they could manipulate it when it came by taking advantage of foreign exchange. He perceived, moreover, that once established, a contraction of the currency might be forced to an extreme, and that when money rose beyond price, as in 1825, debtors would have to surrender their property on such terms as the creditors might dictate. This is the kernel. The modern revelation of the usurocratic mechanism remained at this point until Arthur Kitson gave his evidence before the Macmillan Committee, when he traced the curve, showing the relationships between debt and credit after the Napoleonic Wars, after the American Civil War, and their bearing on the post-Versailles period. Notice today the American propaganda in favour of a return to gold. Aristotle mentions the olive press monopoly practiced by Thales just to prove that a philosopher could easily outwit other people if he had nothing better to do, or if he did not find the exercise of his cerebral faculties more interesting. The monopoly of money, or the restriction of its circulation, is merely a variation of this simple form of monopoly. That is all. The stupid fall into the trap. Wars are provoked in succession, deliberately, by the great usurers, in order to create debts, to create scarcity, so that they can extort the interest on these debts, so that they can raise the price of money, i.e. the price of the various monetary units controlled by or in the possession of these same usurocrats, altering the prices of the various monetary units when it suits them, raising and lowering the prices of the various foodstuffs when it suits them, completely indifferent to the human victim, to the accumulated treasures of civilization, to the cultural heritage. Every revolution is betrayed. The story of the young American Republic may serve to a certain extent as a warning to the Italian Republic of today. Just as any other exact knowledge of history may be useful to the understanding of the historical process in times of crisis. The victory of the American armies, Lord Cornwallis's surrender, etc., did not end the secular war between producer and usurer, which continued, if somewhat subdued, without the slightest truce. The idea that a war might ever have abolished interest on debt was regarded with irony by one of the fathers of the Republic. After a few skirmishes between advance patrols, there came an action in the grand style now known as the Scandal of the Assumption. The manoeuvre was classic. The soldiers of the revolution had been paid by the various colonies in paper money that recognised the debt of the colony to the veteran. These certificates of indebtedness began to lose their purchasing power, which fell to 20% of the face value. $100 in certificates were worth only 20. At a certain moment, 29 members of the National Congress, in league with their friends, bought up large quantities of the certificates. After this action, the nation, now newly organised as an executive unit, assumed the responsibility of paying them at par. And Claude G. Bowers, former US ambassador in Spain, gives the details in his Jefferson and Hamilton. Hamilton's racial origins have never been determined with certainty, though his eloquence, suavity, and drawing room talents suggest a certain affinity with the abilities of Disraeli. Jefferson, who opposed Hamilton's manoeuvres, pinned his faith on the Secretary of the Treasury, Gallatin of Swiss origin. A certain prejudice was aroused against Gallatin, but Jefferson insisted that he was the most able man in the administration after the President, i.e. after himself. Jefferson professed not to understand agriculture, adding deferentially, "But Mr. Madison, he does." He claimed a certain ignorance of economics. He insisted that the bank was useful because it gave ubiquity to Gallatin's money. And in fact, the bank gave it this ubiquity. Giving ubiquity to purchasing power is one of the perfectly legitimate and very useful functions of banks. But to temper any exaggerated admiration of the workings of usurocratic procedures that may have become sanctified by habit, we may note that John Adams exclaimed in his old age, "Every bank of discount is downright corruption, taxing the public for private individuals' gain, and if I say this in my will, the American people would pronounce I died crazy." Some 10 years ago, I had occasion to condense the introductory study of American history into a book of less than 30 lines. This book shows that Jefferson was less ignorant of finance and money than his modesty would have pretended. Here are my four chapters. Chapter 1. All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise, not from defects in their constitution or confederation, not from want of honour or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. John Adams. Chapter 2. And if the national bills issued be bottomed, as is indispensable, on pledges of specific taxes for their redemption within certain and moderate epochs, and be of proper denomination for circulation, no interest on them would be necessary or just, because they would answer to everyone the purposes of the metallic money withdrawn and replaced by them. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to Crawford, 1816. Chapter 3. And gave the people of this republic the greatest blessing they ever had, their own paper to pay their own debts. Abraham Lincoln. Chapter 4. The Congress shall have power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. And that is from the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Legislative Department, Section 8, Clause 5. Done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present the 17th day of September, in the year of our Lord 1787, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th, in witness whereof we have hereunto subscribed our names. George Washington, President and Deputy from Virginia. It should be noted that only the last of these statements is to be found in a publication, easily accessible to the great majority of the citizens of the great but denatured democracy. The American Constitution, from which it is taken, is written in a style that is not very attractive to the average reader. The key phrases come a long way after the beginning, and the citizen gets bored before he catches up with them. For years now, Congress has taken no notice of the powers it has been invested with by this document. Now and then, some crank from Nebraska or Dakota raises an uncouth voice to demand a little of the liberty proclaimed by the fathers of the Republic, but the roar of the rotary presses soon drowns such rustic vociferations. One day, thinking of the trouble it had cost me to unearth these four chapters, I asked the head of the American History Department of the Library of Congress if there existed a History of America, whether in one volume or in ten, that contained these four chapters or the substance of them. After reflecting for a while, he replied that, so far as he knew, I was the first to have brought together, and in relation to each other, the four great names of the greatest presidents of the Republic. Lincoln was assassinated after he made the statement given earlier. The theatrical gesture of the assassin does not explain how it happened that he escaped from Washington after the alarm had been raised by the only road that was not guarded, nor its synchronization with the attempted assassination of Seward, the Secretary of State, nor various other details of the affair. The fact remains that Lincoln had assumed a position in clear opposition to the usurocracy. For a clearer understanding, American history may be divided into the following periods. Number one, the colonial period, up to the suppression of the paper money in 1750. Number two, preparation for the break with England of 1776. The revolution, said John Adams, took place in the minds of the people during the 16 years preceding the Battle of Lexington. Number three, formation and organization of the New Order, culminating in the struggle between Hamilton for the bankers and Jefferson for democracy. It must be admitted that Washington came under Hamilton's influence. John Adams, the second president, held the high office for only 4 years. Jefferson ruled for 8 years as president, and for a further 16, during which he guided his successors. Next came Madison, 8 years, Monroe, 8 years, and then Adams' son for only 4 years, like his father, before him. Number four. The fourth period covers the 12 years of Jackson, 8, and Van Buren, 4, but the decade of 1830 to 1840 has disappeared from the schoolbooks. The public knows, and schoolchildren get taught, that Jackson killed a few Redskins, chewed tobacco, and beat the English at New Orleans after the Peace of Ghent, but before news of its signing had arrived. This military victory of the hero of New Orleans was nevertheless of service to America, for no one will be so ingenious as to suppose that London would have observed the treaty had the British forces won the battle. But the real war was the war between the bank and the people, waged and won for the people by Jackson and Van Buren. This is the fact that explains the silence of history and the small respect paid to Van Buren throughout the whole period of America's decadence, which dates from Lincoln's assassination. Usurocracy, defeated by the operations of Jackson and Van Buren, next directed its beam of obfuscation onto the question of Negro slavery, or chattel slavery, as it was called. The dramatic and sentimental possibilities of this problem were far superior to those immediately visible in the bank struggle. During the pre-war phase, the debates in Congress reveal an extremely penetrating perception on the part of the more intelligent members. But after Lincoln's death, discussions lost much of their clarity. The indebtedness of the South to the city of New York took second place. The subject lost its news value. Usurocracy had discovered that the slave-owning system was less profitable than that of free labour. Anyone who possessed a slave had to keep him alive and in a fit condition to work. This cost more than free labour, in respect of which, under the capitalist system, the employer had no responsibility whatsoever. The defeat of the slave owners was already determined, pre-determined. Perhaps the elements of conscience and idealism never played so important a part in the preparation of a war as in the present instance. The problem of mass emotion is not a mathematical or a monetary problem, but when the passions of the multitude are aroused, certain banking elements set about to exploit the situation. The aim of the Civil War was unmasked in an issue of the Hazard Circular in 1862. The great debt that our friends, the capitalists of Europe, will see to it is made out of the war must be used to control the volume of money. It will not do to allow the greenback, as it is called, to circulate, for we cannot control their issue and circulation. As for the system which allowed the national money of the United States of America to be controlled by finance, namely, the usurocracy which was then established in London, it is summed up in a letter dated 25th of June, 1863, from the Rothschild firm in London to the firm of Eichelheimer, Morton and Vandergould in New York, containing the following words. Very few people will understand this. Those who do will be occupied getting profits. The general public will probably not see it is against their interest. This opinion of the various Shermans and Rothschilds proved to be perfectly right. The protests of the minority representatives in the United States and of various cranks elsewhere have failed to overcome the power of the usurers and of the international usurocratic press, including that of England, France, and Italy. The Comte de Vergennes had every reason to say to John Adams that the newspapers ruled the world. John Adams' great-grandson had every reason to write that after Waterloo, the power of the usurers met with no serious defeat. The first serious attempt against them, after Lincoln's, began with the Fascist Revolution, to be reaffirmed by the formation of the Rome-Berlin Axis. University textbooks throughout the whole of the century of usury, known as the 19th, were written to maintain the domination of usury and to keep the professors in their chairs. A book like D.R. Dewey's Financial History of the United States contains an enormous quantity of incontrovertible facts, but omits those which are really relevant and revealing. These cardinal facts on which the whole problem turns are only to be found in a few pamphlets that slip through the controls, or in fundamental works in which their discovery requires great patience on the part of the reader. 100 pages of reading matter for 3 revealing lines. Conclusion. What? Finished already? No doubt the reader expects me to explain myself further, but I am not so sure. I have, I think, given the facts necessary for an understanding of the problem of war, of wars in succession. I might go on explaining and heaping up additional facts for 600 pages or more. In 1878, a member got up in Congress and expressed the hope that he might keep some of the non-interest-bearing national debt in circulation as currency. One reader in 500 will understand this remark. And I am quite sure that the record of this capricious proposal survives only in one contemporary newspaper clipping, apart from its internment in the archives of the American Capitol. The state can lend. The fleet that was victorious at Salamis was built with money lent to the shipbuilders by the state. The practice of state loans fell into evil repute because the emperors of the Roman decadence allowed money to be lent to unworthy borrowers who did not repay it. Wisdom resides less in the means than in the affirmation of ends. If there is the will to attain the end, the means will be found. If the end is perfidious, No means can have in itself any inherent virtue capable of preventing the perversion of justice. Against this, it may be observed that certain systems and certain mechanisms of means have been purposely invented and set working in order to mislead the public and to keep them ignorant of the facts of history and of the best means of creating and maintaining social justice. The ideological and propagandist battle should be directed against the practice of this obscurantism. In recent centuries, gold has been used by the bankers, mainly as an instrument for creating scarcity. A scarcity, in the first instance, of gold itself in a certain locality, nation or nations, strategically determinative. For a long time now, the gold standard has not, in fact, existed. What has existed has been a false gold standard. The abolition of a so-called gold currency or of a paper currency issued in a variable relationship to a real or supposed quantity of gold and the institution of a currency based on work would have one great advantage. Work cannot be monopolized. But all the artful dodges of accounting used by the usurers to manipulate the present forms of money would be attempted in the case of any new kind of money. In this respect, the conservatives who cry, "No monkeying about with money," are quite right. But the fundamental fraud is monopoly. It is necessary to understand this. It is necessary to understand how it has been practiced from the year 1694, when the Bank of England was founded, until today. It is necessary to perceive that Napoleon and several other heads of states have been struggling against the same snares and pitfalls, the same trickery. The history of the last 25 years in Europe is unknown to the Italian people, and especially to the authorities and economists of Italy and Germany. A summary of the League of Nations' infamy is contained in Odon Paul's Politica Economico-Sociale in Italia. The usurer's assault was launched from London and Washington, united in operation. In 1863, the central office was in London and the branch in New York. Today, the position is reversed. The headquarters across the Atlantic and the branch in London. The role of France is known. Mussolini was condemned by the international usurocracy from the moment he discovered the connection between the usurers in New York and their creatures in Moscow. This is all fairly well known throughout Italy. I have tried to piece together a little of the earlier state of affairs behind the scenes. The Bolshevik was a sham, and to a certain extent a betrayed revolution. Bolshevism proposed to destroy capital, but what it did was to destroy property, particularly peasant property. Stalin's attack on capitalism in his Foundations of Leninism merits attention. He thoroughly understands the iniquity of the various Roosevelts, Churchills, Blooms and the rest of them. But Bolshevism stooped to the methods of economic warfare, flooding foreign markets with goods and foodstuffs at cut prices. And with the purchase of the Suez Canal shares, it has now frankly embarked on a financial war. It is allied up to the hilt with liberalism, for the liberals always get around to talking of the export of manpower, of human beings, that is, in exchange for foodstuffs. Stalin disposes of 40 truckloads of human material for work on a canal. The only difference is one of economic detail. The enormous perversion is common to each tentacle of the monster. Number one, wars are made to create debts. Number two, war is the highest form of sabotage, the most atrocious form of sabotage. And number three, a nation that will not get itself into debt drives the usurers to fury. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part two of Roosevelt and the Causes of the Present War.